Don't you think COVID shutdown was a bit like Quest? And then now we're like in this long, drawn out return.
Whoa. Oh, I just got shivers thinking about that. The pandemic as initiation is very, very powerful, I think, as a perspective to consider. Yeah. You're smart.
Right? Not just a pretty face. Pretty smart.
I think you're so right. And kind of to what I was saying earlier, like, it kind of feels like we shat the bed on it a little bit collectively. The return is not great.
No, look at what's going on in the world.
And I have, and still have, I will say, like a little bit of a hang up about learning about Egypt from white people or like English and French speaking people. I'm like, what are you filtering out as you interpret this culture that I, again, like, I'm not sure I can trust you. And this is not part of our culture and our traditions when in fact it was. So there's this really kind of like multi-layered impacts of colonization where first someone from outside came in and said, what you're doing is not okay. And then a couple of generations later, that's been totally internalized by the people who are now oppressing their own people for doing something that is like maybe more culturally relevant than, you know, being just like straight.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Conversations with Your Chinese Auntie, Yi. That's me. In this episode, I talked to my dear friend Lara. Lara and I met through our other dear friend Carmen, as we were both Questers and Carmen's students. This episode discusses Lara's trip to Egypt, capitalism, Quest, and the return, and self-initiation. We talk about how the pandemic is like an initiation, and we are now in the return. Dun, dun, dun. It will all make sense when you listen to this episode. At the end of the episode, I talk about self-initiation a bit more. And of course, advice from your Chinese auntie is there too. Hello, Lara.
Hi, Patricia.
Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Please introduce yourself.
Great. Okay. My name is Lara Terrien-Boulos. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a cis queer woman living on Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh lands, more recently known as North Vancouver, BC, Canada. And this is also where I grew up or spent most of my childhood. And recently moved back here into my childhood home with my partner, and we're living with my mom, which has been really cool. I am Egyptian and French Canadian in terms of my ancestry. I went to Egypt for the first time just over a year ago, which has been a big part of my current journey, I guess, of finally getting to visit that place. And what else? I'm a devoted older sibling. I have like big sister energy, which is like a big part also of some of the things I'm unlearning, the like eldest daughter, big sister stuff. I am a partner. I am a friend. I'm an animist. A bunch of other things, I'm sure, but I think those are probably, I'm an artist. That's something that I've more recently started claiming and not having as much fear around. Yeah, just unlearning a lot of kind of capitalist bullshit around like what makes an artist. So I'm an artist. I'm a writer. Creative person, bridge builder, and like kind of mouthy, critical person as well.
Okay, to be fair, I didn't tell you this before. Try not to swear, because if not, I have to make the episode explicit.
Noted. Did I just swear? I don't think I did.
No, I said try not to swear.
Okay. I was like, what did I just say even? I don't know.
Because our other friend was on before you and...
Were they dropping some...
Just one. Oh, and I decided to keep it because it was kind of spicy.
That's fun. Okay. Well, I will keep that in mind. We'll see how spicy our conversation gets.
Yeah.
Maybe some swears will be warranted.
If it's warranted, I'll just list it as explicit. It's all good with me.
Right on.
So you and I have known each other for 7 years, maybe?
I want to say I met Carmen in 2018, so it would have been about 6 years.
Yeah. I would love to hear about your Egyptian side. Because we never really talked much about that.
Yeah, great.
Did you grow up having that influence?
It was part of my upbringing, mostly through food. My dad is Egyptian, and he came here when he was 18 in the late 60s. He followed his first brother, his oldest brother, who had immigrated a year prior, and then his other brother and his parents came in the 70s. So his whole nuclear family was in Canada, and I grew up, you know, going to visit them and my grandparents, my grandmother mostly, because my grandfather passed when I was quite young. But they all lived out in Eastern Canada, and we were kind of the only ones here in Vancouver. So there was a little bit of distance. And then, of course, like my parents were in an intercultural, interracial marriage, and my mom was very, very adamant about wanting to speak French to us and share our Francophone culture, which was wonderful. And we still speak French together and we're fluent, which is such a gift. And she really wanted my dad to speak Arabic to my sibling and me. And he really resisted, I think like many immigrants, I mean, every immigrant has a different story, of course, but my dad's was, I think, one of buying into assimilating as the way to integrate into this new homeland. And he really turned his back, I think, on his birth country when he left for a variety of very understandable reasons. And so he didn't really want to teach us Arabic. And so language was not a part of our upbringing, or like Egyptian, I guess Arabic language was not a part of our upbringing, but he loves to cook. And so I grew up eating quite a lot of Egyptian food, I would say. And then he would kind of tell us stories a little bit about his childhood. Like we would ask him to tell us about Egypt. And I don't really remember the things that he would tell us, but I do remember once that he like told me a bedtime story about being on a camel in the desert or something, and like maybe the camel kind of getting out of control, or I don't really know. And then I asked him to tell me that story again sometime later, and he was like, what story? And it turned out that he had made it up. And so I think that I grew up a little bit also maybe not totally trusting the things that he would tell us about Egypt because of that one experience that really stuck, where I was like, I don't know if I can trust it. I think I don't know if I can trust you on these things.
So you have started in the last few years really connecting with that side of the ancestry.
Yeah.
And then you went to Egypt last year. What have you learned that stood out to you?
Yeah.
And maybe, what have you incorporated into your day-to-day life?
Yeah, those are great questions. I feel like in the overall journey of my identity development, like when I think about things, I was a pretty like kind of feisty teen. I was pretty feminist at a pretty early age, but I would say it was mostly like second wave feminist, like not so intersectional at first. And then that kind of moved into developing an environmentally focused consciousness. And then in my early 20s was when I learned about colonization in so-called Canada and the way that Canada has treated the Indigenous peoples on these lands. And that really led me down a lot of interrogation around the settler part of my history and ancestry, like the French settler part of my ancestry. And I did a bunch of ancestral work and found, you know, ancestors that go as far back as 10 or 11 generations in terms of like really being part of the early colonization project of these lands. And it took me a long time to make space for the exploration of my Egyptianness. I think also as a light-skinned mixed person with white skin privilege, I don't think I was giving myself the permission to be mixed, you know, and I think also because a lot of my childhood, you know, I grew up in upper middle class, highly educated family. It's like kind of like capital L liberal kind of vibes, you know, of like diversity, but not necessarily going deeper than that. You know, multiculturalism as the like, let's eat each other's foods, but not really like understand each other's struggles and each other's stories on a deeper level. And so I think that that kind of is a part of the reason that it took me until my late 20s to even give myself the permission to explore the parts of me that are not part of the dominant cultures in these lands. So that's like a very long-winded kind of tracing of part of the journey of how I got to now. And in terms of like that actual process of exploring what it is to be a mixed person, multiracial person, and being Egyptian especially, I think for me there were two big things that gave me a lot of maybe imposter syndrome or like challenging towards myself of like feeling Egyptian. One of them is the language piece, like just not being able to engage with one of my birth cultures directly. And I think also because Egypt and like ancient Egypt is like so exotified and fetishized by people. Everyone has an idea, right, of what that culture is. And I have and still have, I will say, like a little bit of a hang up about learning about Egypt from white people or like English and French speaking people. I'm like, what are you filtering out as you interpret this culture that I, again, like, I'm not sure I can trust you. Interesting. A lot of like distrust kind of coming up in my narrative so far. I'm just noticing like, don't trust my dad. Don't trust, you know, like white folks writing about Egypt. And so there was always this kind of thing of like, well, how am I going to like, how can I do this? Right. Like I can't read or write or understand Arabic. And so I don't have access to the wealth of knowledge that is like being written about by Egyptians about Egypt. Not that that's uncomplicated either because of Arabization and like a bunch of other things that we could talk about. But anyways, that was the first big hang up was like language barrier and the impact of having other cultures talking about my birth culture. And then I think the second big thing was that I had never been. And there, it was for such a, like really for the first 33 years of my life, it was such a huge wound, like so much grief there. Because again, like part of my mother's project when we were growing up was to try to convince my dad to take us together, you know? And it just never happened. There was always like a reason not to or whatever. He wasn't in a place where that's something he wanted to do. And then as I became an adult, I think I was still holding on to this desire to go with him specifically. And so that was like kind of a self-imposed barrier. And then I got to a point where I was like, I'm an adult. I could just go. But then I thought, well, maybe I'll learn Arabic and then I'll go. And so then it was also this other self-imposed barrier where I was like, well, I have to speak the language before I go. And then in late 2022, my sibling and I had taken some time off work. I was pretty burnt out and I was taking some extended time off. And my sibling was kind of in between jobs and projects and things. And literally on the very same day, I texted them, like they had asked me, can we have a phone call? And I wasn't available. But then I texted them and I was like, should we just go to Egypt like next month? You know? And they texted me back and they were like, that's literally why I wanted to talk to you on the phone today. They were having the same idea. And it was like the stars just aligned. The timing was right. We were both just kind of like, let's go. But we were like, this is like the time is now, you know, like why wait? Let's do it. And so I think we booked a ticket to go 4 weeks later, 5 weeks later. And it was really, yeah, like a really feels like it was like so many things aligning to make it possible. I guess the other thing I'll also say too is that there had been a couple of other times leading up to that moment where I had made a plan to go maybe like 6 or 9 months later, and then something would always come up. And so I think that there was something about like this short window of time between deciding and going that made it possible. I think part of the reality too with that part of the world actually is that it's kind of like that. Like stuff happens there all the time. I mean, we're witnessing a genocide happening in Palestine now as we speak. There's so much conflict that is centered in my homelands and the neighboring regions and places. And so it can actually be hard to plan to go. And so I think that those were some of the many reasons that made it challenging to get there. And then we went. And leading up to going, I was really, like I was working in therapy and really reflecting on how I wanted to go there. And I was really keen to do my best not to project or expect anything. Just knowing that it would be so easy to be disappointed or confused. And so I think I really did a pretty good job actually of going in, just being open to whatever it might feel like to be there. But it was such an incredible experience, like stepping off the plane and into the airport and out into the like warm desert night air. And like I felt my body recognizing the place. And that was really powerful and unexpected. And then the rest of the trip, like it, that continued to feel that way. And many people would go up to either my sibling or myself and be like, "Are you from here?" That was really affirming too, you know, being recognized by people as being of that place. So there were a couple of really meaningful experiences there. And I think really what I've incorporated as I've come back in the last year is that like, I don't have that hang up anymore. I don't have the hang up of like, am I really Egyptian if I've never been, or I don't speak the language, or like blah, blah, blah. Like all of that really is something that I was able to shed when I went. And I feel much more centered and clear in who I am. And I feel like that is carrying into all of the parts of my life in really beautiful ways, subtle and not so subtle, but really welcome.
Have you, no, let me rephrase this. When you say being recognized, when people came up to you, that does something to your nervous system. Because when you're biracial and you don't know, having that recognition, it says a lot to you going, home.
Absolutely. I think like in my pre-trip and pre like all of this kind of these parts of my journey that I just shared, like before that, I would jokingly sometimes self-identify as beige. Like I would kind of like, you know, find ways to make light of the ambiguity of my identity. And I think because it's hard for people to read me here, you know, like I could be white, I could be so many different things. People guess all sorts of things and don't usually end up with Egyptian as part of their guesses or assumptions about who I am. And so, yeah, I think really going there and being read in that way was super affirming.
Have you felt that anywhere else? You've traveled a bit.
I have. Not really, I would say. Like, I think maybe part of it is because of the places that I've been. Like, I haven't been anywhere else in the Botswana region, like Southwest Asia, North Africa necessarily, where, you know, could be potentially perceived as a distant relative or cousin, you know. I think I've had moments of feeling quite a high level of comfort and enjoyment being in certain places that were new to me. Like I remember feeling that in Florence in Italy, and I remember feeling that in Istanbul in Turkey, and maybe one or two other places. But yeah, not in the same way, not at all in the same way.
For me, it was Spain.
Oh, I would love to know more.
So my niece was baptized in Spain. That's a whole different story. But she was baptized in Spain. So we went to Spain first, to Barcelona, because my niece has two godmothers, me one, and then my sister's best friend, Eva. And they decided to baptize my niece in Spain. So everybody went to Spain. And it was a great trip. But I step out of the van in Barcelona, looked at the Colosseum. And at that time, they were renovating. So there was only the front wall. And it was that sense of, I'm here. I've been here before, and I'm home. And I was like, huh.
So interesting.
And, you know, and I don't have a lot of places where I feel like that.
Mm-hmm.
With your trip. So my sense, I've never been, but my father has always told me that his perception of this is a very holy land. You got to respect the land when you're there. You see, because there's a lot of history. What did you find when you were there?
It's such a fascinating place. And I think that's such an interesting perspective from your dad, actually, because I feel like I definitely felt the depth of the history of that place. Like, I think it's inevitable when it's so visible in some ways, right? To really feel it and see it. And at the same time, I feel like there are other places in the world where I've felt that awe that comes with that holiness. And sometimes it's just in the natural world and has nothing to do with human-made things. So I think that's an important aspect as well. But in Egypt specifically, I mean, I remember just like being with the Nile or on the Nile and just being like, this river is so mythical. Like it's so, and it is truly like the source of life for this, you know, otherwise deserted place. And so incredible to see just like a couple of kilometers on either side of the Nile, there's green and there's, you know, growth and irrigated fields and fruit trees, and like it's quite lush. And then it's just like desert. Like the line is so stark. So that was fascinating. And then these beautiful old ancient temples superimposed with many also beautiful mosques and churches. I think it does make for a multi-layered, very spiritually potent place. And it's also really interesting because, of course, like Egypt now is places change a lot, but Egypt now is a really different place than it was, you know, 60 years ago when my dad left and before. And it is also a place where there is, you know, dominant religion, like the dominant religion of Islam. Part of the reason my family left is because we're Coptic Egyptian, which is the Christianity of Egypt. And so there's a good amount of discrimination and less, you know, economic and educational opportunity in many ways for Christians. And then it's kind of like there's Christians, there's Muslim folks, and then there's like nothing else, supposedly, right? It's like quite binary in terms of like what religions are perceived to be in the space. Although we did have a tour guide who shared with us that some people are doing like, I guess, maybe modern worship of the ancient Egyptian deities. But on your ID card as an Egyptian, it says what your religion is. And like ancient Egyptian spirituality is not one of the choices. So you might have like someone who's Muslim on the card, but who might be incorporating spiritual practices from ancient Egypt, but you would never know it. Or, you know, the tour guide was saying like, often people will only find that out about a relative when they're going through their things after they've passed and they find like a statue of an old Egyptian god or other evidence that they were also perhaps, yeah, incorporating other spiritual practices and deities into their lives. which I think is so fascinating.
What is the purpose of putting the religion on the ID card?
I don't know. If I were to guess, and I say this, you know, with not a lot of context or knowledge, because Egypt is an Islamic republic, it is a country that is not secular. Mm. I think it probably has something to do with that. Another form of social stratification or control, or like putting people in boxes, I think, perhaps, that, you know, we see it all in all sorts of places in all sorts of ways.
So even though you tried to go in with no expectation, were there a few things that were shocking?
Yeah, there were a couple of things that surprised me. One being that, like, as much as I was familiar with Egyptian food from growing up with some of it, we ate a bunch of other things that were also not as familiar. And I think part of it actually was that a lot of the things that my dad made for us growing up is more home food. And because we were eating in restaurants a lot, we were maybe being exposed to not necessarily the kinds of things that people eat at home, but the things that they actually would make the effort to go out and enjoy together. So that was really cool. I think the other thing that was very obvious that I've experienced in other places as well, but that felt quite present, was just like immediately being coded as a woman or a straight woman, with gender being very binary in that society as well. Like, it was really interesting to be like queer people having like a really binary experience of gender and not being read in that way that, like, I would say is easier to be read as queer here. It's like very interesting.
Did you meet other queer people when you were there? Or because it is an Islamic state that it's hidden?
I think there's definitely queer community, and we were not in places or with people that would have given us access to those places. Yeah.
Which makes sense, because I would suspect it isn't safe.
It's not the safest. And I think people are finding their way and they're finding their community, but it's just different. It might just be quieter and less visible than perhaps in other parts of the world, but it doesn't mean that it's not there. And I think that there are some things that are changing. It's not linear, that's for sure. But, you know, yeah. I will say, like, something that was so interesting too is, like, speaking of ancient Egyptian gods, the god of the Nile was like described to us again by tour guides as, I think, a man with women's feature, like a man with breasts. That's a trans person, my friends. That is a trans god. And then, like, how incredible that the source of life, the Nile, the god of the Nile, is a gender non-conforming deity. But that's not how they're talked about in a binary society, right? And so, like, all of these things were just so fascinating. There's also a very well-known pharaoh, Hatshepsut, who was, again, scare quotes, a woman who wore men's clothing when she ruled Egypt. I was like, okay, or maybe she was a trans man. I'm like, the most powerful person in that, like, inner culture, like ruling the culture, but potentially, yeah, like, not a woman, you know, wearing men's clothes. So I think it's really interesting to think about that. And I think that there's a lot of nuances that, again, like, people who live in more binary spaces might just miss or interpret completely differently, but that, yeah, like, queer folks might see differently.
You know, it's interesting because I've always thought about this, right? Because in Chinese history, you go back thousands of years with the emperors and the eunuch and the empress, right? And I've always thought whether they didn't look at it as different as we look at it now in our modern society. You know, whether at that time it was like, okay, we see you for who you are. There's no need to differentiate. I wonder whether it's a thing that we do now in this modern day where we try to make people different and stand out.
Absolutely. I think so. I think about, you know, the huge variety of genders that existed and continue to exist on these lands, on this continent prior to colonization, and just like the incredible damage that Christianity caused to Indigenous societies, including demonizing anything that was not a binary, you know, man or woman gender, outlawing certain practices that may have been held by gender nonconforming people who I think in many societies are often medicine people or spiritual liminal folks, right? I know that happened in all over Africa as well, again, with the same kind of European colonization, right? So if we even just look at the last 500-ish years of the world's patterns and like the amount of European and Christian influence the globe over, we have a situation today where a lot of places where homosexuality or queerness was criminalized or outlawed by colonizers, those laws still exist now. And as queer people from those cultures are reclaiming their genders and their practices, their own people are saying, oh, stop being so modern. You're just trying to be like, you know, white queers in the rest of the world. Like you're trying to be Western and this is not part of our culture and our traditions, when in fact it was. So there's this really kind of like multi-layered impacts of colonization where first someone from outside came in and said, what you're doing is not okay. And then a couple of generations later, that's been totally internalized by the people who are now oppressing their own people for doing something that is like maybe more culturally relevant than, you know, being just like straight. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole another topic, because you look at countries like China, you know, not widely accepted to be queer, non-binary. And then you look at Malaysia, is an Islamic state. There's a death sentence for being queer. Publicly.
Yeah.
I've always just wondered what humans in the last hundreds of years, colonization has done to all these cultures. So,
And I think like, you know, colonization, no matter who's doing it, colonization and imperialism is ultimately about a homogenization process, right? It's like, if everyone is the same, it's easier for us to control people. It's easier for us to punish people who step out of line, because the box is quite clear and it's narrowly focused and defined. And so that makes it easy to then stay in control and have that, yeah, and just have that be easier to do. Bummer. Wow, what a downer. How did we get here so fast?
Also, the irony is you try to fit everybody into a box, but people stand out.
Yeah, absolutely. And even going back to my own personal story of like maybe growing up more in the box, right? It's been this process of at least a decade now of looking at the box and deciding if I want to be in the box and kind of seeing stuff outside of it and being like, hey, that's actually kind of cool. Maybe this applies to me. Maybe I want to go and explore this, and giving myself the permission to do that and being around people who are also doing that, like you, right? Like I look at the people who are in my life now and I think all of us are pretty outside of those boxes, and that's part of why they're in my life. And there's just so much more that we can do outside of those constraints. And it can just take a long time for any of us to trust that that's true and to maybe calm the fear that comes with the perceived safety of conforming, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, speaking for myself as an immigrant, I tried to fit into the box when I came here, and for like probably like 20 years. But then very soon, and a lot of immigrants that I've talked to, very soon you realize we just don't fit. Then, so you might as well just embrace the differences and go, this is who I am. I've spoken to some girlfriends who grew up here too, and they try for years, even growing up here, going to a school that was predominantly white. They're like, I'm either too tall, my hair is too black, or the food that my mom gave me to take to school smell, and all the kids make fun of me. But then you try to dress the way that your peers, your white peers dress, and you still don't fit in.
You
trick yourself into thinking that you fit in, but you don't fit in.
Yeah. And then as you start deconstructing, like, why am I even trying to fit in the first place? Then I think that's where a lot of the veil kind of comes down. It also feels right now to me like we're in this moment of like a lot of clarity and like awakening happening for a lot of people around like just how much we have been manipulated and lied to and like invited into this delusion of capitalism and white supremacy and colonial patriarchal life. And again, like, I think that what's happening in Palestine is like really shifting a lot for a lot of people and opening their eyes to, okay, well, if the narrative about Israel that I've been fed for so long is so incredibly false, because now I'm learning, people are learning about the things that mainstream media never shared, now that, you know, Israelis don't control the narrative, social media has brought a lot of direct information forward into the light. So if we were wrong about that, how many things are we wrong about? And like, oh, look at what's happening over here with, you know, colonization of indigenous peoples and like so many struggles that have been ongoing since, you know, the first settlers set foot on these lands, really. Like, let's draw some parallels. Let's understand how these are part of the worldwide mechanism of power and control and accumulation of wealth for a very, very few number of people. I think there was like this like glimmer at the beginning of the pandemic as well, when there were lockdowns and like the world kept turning and we were like, wait, so we don't have to work all the time? I feel like we've lost that a little bit, which is unfortunate, because I was really excited when that started to happen. I was like, yes, general strike, let's go. I mean, I still feel that way. Like, why are we selling our souls to the capitalist gods? And it's like, yeah, we've been told so many things about how life is and what we should do and what the meaning is. And I think some of that is crumbling. I think the edges of the box are becoming clearer. And I think fewer and fewer people want to live in it. But I'm curious to see what we can do to really like transform things. I'm so ready for it. I've been ready.
I've been ready too, but I would be curious to see whether it happens in our lifetime.
Yeah. I think there's also the danger of like, my perception is that we're quite clear on what we're fighting against, and there's maybe less clarity about what we're working towards building. And I think that that's something that I've certainly felt like in the activism communities that I've been a part of, like we're so good at tearing stuff down. I mean, I even called myself like a mouthy critical person in my intro. Like, I can tell you what's wrong, but I don't know that we've totally dialed into what we do want. And I think there are lots of incredible examples. And again, I would say it's like mostly racialized people, queer people, disabled people who are like holding up the vision for the future that we can all be part of and that, you know, can make room for all of us. But I think we run the risk of like being too good at tearing ourselves down from within communities where, in theory and I wish in more practice, like we could come together and embrace the differences of what we're doing. I guess it's like there's a thing that's happening in activist communities here anyways, and like this region or this part of the world, where like there's also an expectation of homogeneity, which kind of is going against what we say we want, because there's this like nonsense homogenous, you know, like hegemonic thing of like everyone has to be the same in empire. Like, not everyone needs to be the same in the revolution, and we're not actually making enough space for that to be true. If we're expecting everyone in the revolution to think exactly the same way and to do exactly the same thing and to be like perfectly impeccable in their word and use the right language And like all we end up doing is fighting with each other over our tactics and how we talk about stuff and like all of those things, and we're not coming together, then the empire has a really good chance of just kind of like just holding on to power. Or even if we make gains in the revolution, but we haven't figured out like what we're working towards, then I think that's where it can get cut down and compromised, you know?
I also think we don't, and I say we as in people who are doing social justice work and activism, I also think part of the reason we don't know what we're striving for is because we're still living in this capitalistic society, right? Where the rulemakers are still these white men traditionally. So in order to have the insight to build to what we want, we almost need to look at, if we take out the system, we need almost, I think we almost need to aim to build something new and better, you know?
Yeah.
And then the sad thing is we have lost with the pandemic a lot of elders who would have been able to give us the insight.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been thinking about, you know, part of the reason that you and I met was because we were both at a place in our spiritual lives and development where we were seeking guidance and found a place and teachers and opportunity to do that. And when I turned 30, I decided to self-initiate into adulthood because I was like, graduating from high school isn't enough of an initiation into like the rituals that we have again in like mainstream society are like not it. It's not enough. I feel like I need something else to really understand how to step into, yeah, just like living in a good way. And so I did that through Quest, which is partly how we met, and, you know, sat on the land for 4 days and then sat in community with other people who've done that. And we've stayed connected and continue to be in each other's lives as part of that continued initiation journey, I think. And so something that I've been thinking about since I did that process and like as it continues to unfold is like, what is it to step into being an elder and like training yourself to become an elder? Because I also like, I do still have some elders in my life, and I don't, I say this with a lot of love, but like, I don't necessarily want to be like them. A little harsh, but like, you know I have tons of stuff to learn from them. And sometimes it's learning how not to do something, which is valuable. But again, it doesn't help us with the like, well, what are we building? What are the things that we do want to like either preserve from the past and keep alive or bring back from a previous time where like our old ancestors were maybe doing some things that we can learn from? And then, yeah, but then absolutely you're right, like the ancestors or the elders that are now ancestors that we've lost in the last 5 years, like I feel like there's a huge depth of loss there. Absolutely. I've had a few elders pass in the last few years, and I've had a lot of time to think about death and endings. And I think we're not great in our society at endings. In a society where literally it's like forever growth is the thing, and there's no space for death and endings, there's obviously a connection there. But I also have been having a lot of conversations recently about, you know, when you don't take that linear approach and you look at cycles, death is also birth. Endings also make space for beginnings. And so, yeah, I think that's also really important to remember.
I remember growing up in Singapore, a lot of the elders will talk about sometimes in families, an elder would die and then soon after a baby would be born.
Yeah.
So it's that soul leaving, making space and for the new soul to come in. Yeah.
That's so beautiful. That actually happened with me. My Egyptian grandfather passed like 2 months after I was born. And similarly for my sibling, our grandmother passed 4 months before my sibling was born.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. And it happened recently. My aunt passed away in the fall. And my cousin's baby was born like 6 months before that. I've always wondered about that. That's so beautiful that there's, yeah, these like stories or these perspectives in your culture that really look at that.
Since you brought up Quest, so for the listeners, Quest is, we did it with our friend and teacher, Carmen. And it's 4 days, four nights, solo time on the mountain, 100 hours fasting, but you can drink water and you're on your own. And Carmen and Ruben are at base camp in case you need anything.
Yeah. And I think I would also add that all of that is held also in relationship with the people from the nation on whose land that is, which is the Soquitmic people, and Elder Norman Retasket in particular, who's just the sweetest, most wonderful elder who grounds the work in the land when we arrive and do our preparations before the solo time begins. And I know that he held us and holds Questers in his heart and mind the whole time we're up there too.
Yeah. What did he say? He said, I think first Quest, he said, don't die or something. I can't remember.
To our groups are like, it's so funny. It's funny to hear Carmen tell this story. She'll be like, you know, and then we spent all morning with Elder Norman on our first day there and we're like asking questions. And, you know, I had brought him a gift and I'd like really thought about how I wanted to show up and initiate this relationship with him. So that's really important for me as well. I think especially recognizing that all of us who are doing this work are settlers or were settlers. And so really just taking that seriously too. And so, you know, I like gave him my gift and we sat and listened to all the things that he had to share. And I asked him at the end of the morning, is there anything that you really want us to know or like, you know, to do that is important when we're up on this mountain on your land? And he just goes, don't do anything stupid. Like such a great reminder of like how practical that is, you know. It's like, just don't do anything stupid, don't do anything reckless. But it's true, you know, because like we are there together, we're not the only person who's up there, and so we do have a responsibility to the collective of people that are, you know, fasting as you are, even if you don't see them at all in the 4 days and nights that you're doing your solo work. But yeah, it was just so funny. He's what a wonderful man.
He is so great.
Don't die and don't be stupid.
I think my quest, he's the first quest, I think he said, don't die. He might have said, don't do anything stupid too. And then he added, and don't die. I can't remember. But
so funny.
We should also add that, yes, there's what, 4 days of preparation before and then 3 days of processing after?
Yeah, I think that's right. 3 days of celebrating, integrating. And then getting ready for the return to the rest of the world, which honestly is the actual quest, I think.
I think that is the most shocking part, don't you think?
You know, it's really interesting. I had an experience when I was 15. I went to this camp that was like almost a month long. And it was, I jokingly refer to it as like my leftist education, but it was like a quite left-leaning kind of group of facilitators bringing a bunch of youth from all over the world together to learn from one another and to build solidarity and build a more radical politic, I would say. And it was like such an interesting place, and still have some friends from there that I stay in touch with, which is such a gift. But one of the huge things was that it was also the first place where I felt like I was being treated as an adult, as a teen, which was really important to me as like a pretty smart, precocious, you know, teenager who like obviously thought she knew everything. Now, the older I get, the more I realize I don't know anything. I don't successfully. But I remember coming home from that, like the return from that experience of like being in this alternate reality, really, for a month with peers that were like super interesting adults who were empowering and who heard me and and coming home and, like, you know, my family treating me like nothing had changed. It was so alienating. It was so hard. And I do think that the return from Quest, like, I draw parallels between those experiences for myself of, like, you go away and you can do your best to prepare your people for how you might be when you come back without knowing how you're going to be when you come back. But, like, imagining that it might be different. And not everyone's going to get that. And the, you know, the rest of the world has continued while, like, I don't know, time stopped for me on the mountain a little bit, you know? So it's like a very interesting and challenging thing to go. And I think, like, the main thing is that communities that had rites of passage and sent off their young people to go and do their work, when those young people came back, they were incorporated into a community where every single adult had done that. Mm-hmm. And we don't get that experience nowadays here, right? Even if we do our own self-initiation through something like Quest. So it's a very different experience, and it's really freaking hard.
We're lucky because what Carmen did was for a year you get regular check-ins, so you have that community. And it's interesting that the theory you talk about the experience when you were 15, because for me it felt like that when I came back from yoga teacher training, because I was gone for 2 months. And I came back, but I got the best advice, because there were a few teachers, but one of the men, he said to me and to the group, he said on day one, he said, don't think because you changed in these 2 months that everybody else would have changed, would see things your way when you get back. And I held on to that. I remember when I came back, I had tea with one of my girlfriends, and she was also my mentor. And I was just saying to her, I said, it's so weird and so shocking that you're now looking at things so differently, but everybody else is still doing the same thing.
Yeah. Totally.
But as you were talking about that too, I was thinking, don't you think COVID shutdown was a bit like Quest? And then now we're like in this long, drawn out return.
Whoa. Oh, I just got shivers thinking about that. The pandemic as initiation is very, very powerful, I think, as a perspective to consider. Yeah. You're smart.
Right? Not just a pretty face, pretty smart. Mm-hmm.
I think you're so right. And kind of to what I was saying earlier, like, it kind of feels like we shat the bed on it a little bit collectively. The return is not great.
No, look at what's going on in the world. The genocide. What's going on in Iran, Congo, Sudan?
Yeah.
We are
everywhere. And, you know, it was happening before. It was. Like, I think that's also important, too.
It's
but
true.
I think it's like the interconnectedness of all of that, I think, is what's becoming clearer to more people.
Yes.
I do think there is a bit of a collective awakening. But yeah, I was hopeful in a way that the pandemic might support us to move in a different direction after that experience than what we actually have. What do you think the next round of initiation is going to be? Now I'm asking you questions, but it's your podcast interview now, Patricia.
Da, da, da. So I became a yoga teacher when I was 30. And just in the industry, there's a lot of people who are quite spiritual, some not. But I hung out with a lot of them who were very spiritual, very, you know, they would talk about death. They would talk about past life regressions, things like that. And there was a woman, we were good friends for a while. And she talked about this. This is 20 years ago. She thought at that time, a lot of us would go through an awakening and we would shed what no longer works for us. I don't know if that's happening as fast as we would like it to be. Because, you know, you talk about ego, capitalism, the need for people to work. I'm also the realist in thinking that Mother Nature is angry with us enough that one day she might just go, okay, we're done. Let's just start over.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think makes me think of just like generally the principles around like how to manage collapse of anything, you know, like if something is ending, it's so much easier in the long run to accept it and go with it and move with it and adapt with it than to fight it and try to push against it. Which, like, I'm not saying as a way of being like, climate change is happening anyway, so you may as well just, you know, do whatever. Like, that's really not what I'm trying to say. But, you know, instead of like holding on to the collective delusion that we can keep doing everything that we've been doing that's gotten us to this point, let's get clear on where we are and let's adapt and let's change. And I think you're right. Like the adaptation is very slow. And so it will probably just be more painful for those of us who, you know, live into those times. And we're already in them. I think there's also like, it's important to speak to the privilege that we have of talking about this. Like, I think a lot about people who are, you know, in those places that we mentioned earlier, who are just getting on with the business of survival and who don't have the luxury to sit down and talk about, you know, like how or why or when. Yeah, I think it's important for those of us who have the space to talk about it to also just remember that we also need to be able to translate that into action. And I think that's one of the hardest things for those of us who can talk about it, because we can just stay in that talking place for our entire lives, right? Without doing the necessary transformation to move into a different way of being that these moments require.
Which I think, you know, to answer your question too, is that awakening piece that I talked about too, is I think where we got stuck is that a lot of people, when you and I have talked about this in the spiritual community, it's, I'm just talking, but I'm not doing anything because their perception is, I am not willing to give up the comforts of what I have in order to make a difference. No, I'm not saying everybody's like that, but I'm saying that a majority of them, or there's a big number that are like that, right? So to your point is like, if you don't go with the flow and change, things are going to get hard. And this also applies to life, right? You and I know this, we're being through big changes, is that when universe or spirit comes and go, things are not working, let's do something about it. And most of us as human beings would be like, no, I'm okay. It's comfortable. Let me just keep doing this. And then, you know, spirit comes again and goes, hello?
Hello there.
Hello.
Remember when you were like, I don't want to change? Well, let me tell you, now you have to.
Now you have to. But some people still don't change.
Yeah.
Some people still keep doing what they're doing. Because I don't know. I was talking to one of my girlfriends about this yesterday. Why is it some people like you and I, when spirit comes calling, yes, we might be stubborn the first time, maybe the second time, third time, you're like, rent. And in my case, when spirit came knocking the third time, I had shingles when I was 27. You know, my relationship broke up. I had to change career. Da, 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 da. Mm-hmm. But some people will be like, yeah, no, I'll just keep going.
Same.
So the girl and I were talking about what is the difference that some people would listen to spirit and why some wouldn't?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I feel, you know, one of the things that I distinctly remember about my return from Quest was when I gathered my witnesses. So this is like another aspect in addition to staying in connection with the people that you go up on the mountain with for the year following that and having each other to kind of turn to and track how we're doing. Another aspect was that before you go on quest, you choose some people who you will tell what happened when you come back, and they will reflect things back to you and they will help you carry your story and help you track how you're doing. And so when I did that, one of my witnesses, after I shared what I had experienced on the mountain, just spoke to how courageous I was to go and just like stare at myself, you know, completely naked and be like, all right, what's going on here? Like, let's take stock and let's decide where we're going. And I do think it's true. Like, there is a type of courage that is required to face the reality of who we are and how we might need to change and transform. And it's scary. I think it's too scary for a lot of people.
Do you remember for the 4 days on the mountain?
Yeah.
What was the most scary?
I was so good. I was shocked at how okay I was, actually. Like, and I mean, like, we've talked about this before, our different experiences of the mountain. Like, Patricia's quest, there was like snow the first year and it was like absolutely horrible weather. My group had idyllic sunshine for all 4 days, except for like one little bit of rain. And I know it was drizzling when we went up to, but yeah, you know what? It was horrible the day that we actually went up to the mountain to find our spots. But once we were all on the actual fasting time, it was like so gorgeous and yeah, very sweet.
I'm not bitter at all.
Yeah, I'm sure you're not. But, you know, there's a part of me, because I went in 2019. It was like the year before the pandemic. And I sometimes wonder if part of the reason the mountain was as loving as she was to us was because she knew what was coming and it was going to be bleak. she was like, you know what? I'm going to make this slightly less painful on the weather side, because you're going to need all of the strength and the optimism that you can muster to get through the next year. Yeah, like the pandemic happened during the year of our return.
Yeah.
Gross.
But I'm not bitter that you had great weather and I had to rush through snow up to my knees.
Yeah. I think the things that I carry the most and like remember the most clearly from my time on the mountain are just the feeling of being so deeply embedded in the natural web of the world. And, you know, this idea that you go up there and that you're alone, just completely like breaking down through the experience of being and feeling like so connected. Breaking down any of those kinds of binaries that we live with a lot around like being separate from nature, like people outside of the natural world. Like, it's just so not true. And that was really affirming and beautiful. And I think comes with responsibilities that I still carry and take very seriously.
Yeah, that was another place I felt like home.
Yeah.
But I hated the nighttime when I had to go pee.
Oh, yeah, that's fair.
I imagine that the wolves were there.
Oh, you know, the first night I was falling asleep and I heard a voice and it sounded like I interpreted this person's voice to be a matriarch or like a woman, femme ancestor of the land. And all they said was, huh. And it was so interesting. I was like, oh, are you like witnessing me like being here and arriving here and doing, you know, my work to like set up my little spot and like the ways that I'm working to be respectful of this place? And you're just kind of like, huh. That was so interesting.
She was sort of going, huh, really?
Hey,
I'm just kidding.
Don't judge me.
I'm just teasing. Yeah. My first quest, that was when the Dear Mother showed up. Right, literally, right there. And they're giant on the mountains. Nobody tells you, or nobody told me, the deer on the mountain are huge compared to the deer we see in the city.
I love it. Thick, just chunky, sexy deer up there.
I love it. She showed up and then she stared at me for a long time. You're on my land? Why are you on my land?
Yeah. Yeah, I deeply wish for and really believe that everyone deserves and would benefit from these kinds of experiences and to be welcomed back into communities where we have done that and we're holding each other in accountability for what it is that we learned when we were in those in-between liminal, you know, spiritually very porous times, so that we apply those things to our lives in ways that are in service to justice and liberation for everyone. And not just like a personal everything that I'm thinking of that I could say when I was really crass, but, you know, like not just a personal like victory, not an individualistic pursuit to go and do that for your own self-benefit. Like it's got to be for other people. It has to be for your community. It has to be for other than human kin. It has to be done with, yeah, like that clarity and that responsibility. But I so deeply wish that that was possible for all of us. And that's certainly something that I would like to bring into the reality of that future that we're talking about, like building. Like, what does it involve? I hope it involves that.
Initiations, right? We're lacking that. We're lacking initiations. So
yeah,
I see that in a lot of young people that I work with. You know, it's like it's a bit of like what you said just now. It's like, okay, I finished high school. I'm now thrown into the world. What do I do with myself? I'm supposed to know how to survive. And if there's no rituals or initiations or elders to guide you, you feel so lost for so long.
Yeah. Totally.
A couple more questions for you.
Let's do it. What
I thought
got?
This would be fun to ask you. If you put hemp tea, coffee, or meal with someone dead or alive, let's say dead, who would you pick?
Oh, such a good question. I'm thinking of my uncle who passed a few years ago is this like really, really proud Egyptian man, really proud Coptic man, I should say, like specifically. And you'd always say that Copts are the best because we're the direct descendants of ancient Egyptians.
Ooh.
Because, of course, when Christians came to spread the word, it was ancient Egyptian polytheistic culture that was in Egypt. And then when Muslims came like 7 centuries after that, the people who didn't convert to Islam tended to have the material resources to basically be able to pay to keep their religion. Anyways, so he would always talk about how our ancestors in ancient Egypt were probably like a head scribe or something. Just like, who knows, you know? But like the storyline is like just coming up for me as you ask this question. I would love to talk to like the head of the Library of Alexandria in ancient Egypt. I think that would be so, so cool.
Oh, yeah, that's a great answer.
Right? Great question.
That's some tea, some food.
Yeah, show me some papyrus scrolls. What's going on over here? Like, what is all this beautiful knowledge that you've learned and like amassed in this place that, yeah, was lost when it burned? But I think that would be so, so awesome. I think also one of the first universities was started by a woman in either, I think it was ancient Egypt as well. Maybe her. She'd be cool to talk to.
Mm.
I don't remember her name.
What advice do you have for your younger self?
Trust your intuition. Don't gaslight yourself. Yeah, what you know is in what you feel and sense is probably correct. And it's okay to trust that.
Beautiful. And I just want to note, it's flurries outside. So we're talking about snow on the mountain.
Oh, no. Come back for you. Hauntingly.
Thank you very much.
This is so lovely. I didn't know what to expect other than a great conversation. And we totally had that. I'm so happy and honored that you asked me to chat. And I hope people enjoy listening to us.
I'm sure they will. My intention for the podcast is to have a chat.
Yeah.
Because we don't do this enough.
Yeah, I love that. I've loved all the episodes I've listened to so far. So thank you. And yeah, I'm so grateful you're in my life. You're a great friend.
I try my best. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I love that we talked about initiation. Initiation is a rite of passage marking entrance into society. It can also be a formal admission into adulthood. And many people, especially young people, feel lost as they have not been initiated into adulthood. Imagine this, you're told what to do as a kid, what to wear. And then as a teenager, you have a bit more freedom, hopefully. And if all goes as planned, most of you will go to university or college, but many will feel lost. What do you mean now I need to learn to take care of myself? Nobody has ever taught me that. No one is going to tell me what to do. Hence this week's advice from EE, your Chinese auntie, me, is that if you can self-initiate or find a program in your ancestral lineage to initiate you into adulthood, for goodness sake, don't appropriate other cultures to do this. Like, don't do ayahuasca if it's not in your lineage. Ah, that could be a whole podcast episode. Also, many of you have asked if I will do a few episodes where I share my life story. I will soon, I promise. Be good to yourself and others.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Conversations with Your Chinese Auntie podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. That helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. Also, remember to sign up for our newsletter to receive free materials and updates. Links in the website, patriciapeterson.ca. That's PatriciaPeterson.ca. Again, thanks for listening. We hope you have a great week, and we'll see you in the next episode.